The Picture Show.
Is this where I'm going to be a star?
On News Talk.
It really, I think, is the product of, in a way, it's a watershed of everything I've been doing in my career. All of my movies have, in one way or another, been concerned with social justice in the American context. And what that really boils down to is the state of the American dream and challenges to the American dream, whether they lay in the way we make war, whether, which I did in the film Why We Fight, whether they lay in the house I live in the prison system, which is what I covered in The House I Live In, our war on drugs. And it's an assault on the capacity of so many Americans to enjoy any benefits of the American dream. Every time I've made a film, I think I've been concerned with the struggles that people face in this place that is supposed to be the land of such promise. And I think in The King, I brought that maybe to its most poetic expression. Elvis Presley seemed to me to embody the American dream in such an absolutely genuine and deep and authentic way, that his rise and fall seemed to speak volumes about the rise and fall of the American dream itself. And I thought that was something that would be worth exploring in a film.
Now, I think you've said that what made Elvis great was his raw authenticity, and America had this too. Can you expand a bit on this? I know you.
Sure. I mean, listen. For this comes up all the time. You know, if you make the kind of films I make, the biggest danger of my films is that because I chart difficult developments in the present, facing working people, facing everyday people, facing people who believe in the promise of this country, I'm always holding it up against some idea that there was once something better. And that's tricky because, you know, when was it better? When we genocided the Native American? Was it better when we enslaved Africans? Was it better when we oppressed women even more than we do now? When was it so great? Well, one doesn't have to take the view that it was utopian once upon a time. One only has to recognize that at the birth of this country, the shenanigans and acts of criminality that this country carried out, which are so at odds with the promises of democracy, the fact that we held slaves, the fact that we killed Native Americans, the fact, all that stuff. That's all to say that was standard operating procedure in the old world. Mm. What was new in America was what the framers were doing, despite their own shortcomings as people, what they were doing in advancing the sort of quest for democracy that mankind had been engaged in a little bit further down the field. They had moved the ball just an inch further, and that inch was a global promise. And I think that it was not a specially American dream. It was a global dream, and America branded it once upon a time. And I would argue that we have fallen down on that job. And it's that very heartbreaking shortcoming that is so difficult if you're in America to watch. I mean, what's happening in this country right now makes such a sham of what its promises may have ever been. It's become so cynical, so jaded, and so driven by profit-seeking rather than the pursuit of principle or truth or decency or dignity or any of the words that make our hearts sing. This has just become a cutthroat, winner-take-all experiment in capitalism, and it's playing out with predictable results. People are incredibly, the wealth gap is incredibly vast, more than any other nation in history. People don't have health care. They are worried about their security. They are worried about the ability to make ends meet. You know, it's absolutely soul-crushing. So all the way along, I've been dealing with these issues, and nowhere had I been able to cut at the heart of it, I think, quite the way I had in this film. But it's really never about it was so great once and now it's not. It's that there is a message to the world in the saga of America about the possibility for the 0.001% of positive difference that America represented to a weary world. And I think Elvis shook off the cobwebs of the world that came before him in much the same way that America shook off the cobwebs of the world that came before her. And so it's heartbreaking to watch America lose that moral advantage of authenticity and goodness and become just another corrupt nation that can't stand its politicians. Mm. And the same is true in watching that Elvis bloated, lost, like any other kind of lost soul in Las Vegas, and you think, God, what was he like in Tupelo? Now, He had flaws in Tupelo, just like the country had flaws, but there was that glimmer, and that's what one is so desperate to cling to, because I think that's where the future of the world lies, and we keep seeing the black clouds of the past, you know, obscure that.
Yeah. You say that America is well, the American dream is being unraveled by all that once was beautiful and enduring. Can you talk a little bit about that? I presume you're saying that the kind of Trump age is undermining America's promise.
Yes, Trump is part of it, but you wouldn't have Trump in a healthy country. So it's a mistake to believe that Trump is an exception to this. The reality is that Trump is an expression of this. No healthy country that has a robust and publicly representative democracy and of an informed and alert citizenry, as Eisenhower wished to see, no healthy country like that would ever have come close to a guy like this even being an acceptable candidate, a person who has never spent a moment in public service, who's been an unapologetic capitalist predator his entire life, and also a personal predator with no history of living out values of human dignity, human decency, morality. I mean, only an absolutely weary and heartbroken country would ever have imagined that it's, you know, things are so bad that he could be an improvement. So he is only an expression of the severity of our affliction.
Yeah.
And as such, he can be exactly the kind of critical expression of an affliction that really sends you to the doctor, that you can no longer ignore and sort of write off as, oh, that nagging, you know, cold that I seem to get every winter. It's like, no, you've got some, you know, you've got some deeper condition we've got to look at. And I think Americans are more ready to think of the deeper condition prospect in their lives than ever before. They're seeing that. Look at the Supreme Court thing. It's, you know, we just had Democrats walk out of the Judiciary Committee. You're watching the government itself say these conditions have made even us repulsed. Mm-hmm. Even we no longer can function within this this model, which promised to be one thing but has been hijacked and become another thing. This country doesn't tell its children when we're in school growing up. Nobody writes in our textbooks that, you know, they tell us it's of the people, by the people, for the people. They don't tell it's of corporations, by corporations, and for corporations. They don't tell it's of the elite, by the elite, for the elite. They don't do that. And you grow up to take a bath in that. You learn that you've been totally hoodwinked, and that in fact, the instruments of democracy that, you know, are talked about in the airwaves and are exercised with great pageantry in Washington are in many ways a fig leaf over how the system really runs. And people are figuring that out, and it'll be interesting to see what they do with those discoveries. America's much more naive than Britain. I mean, one of the disappointing things here is that one would hope you could look across the ocean and say, well, our big brother in England, you know, they tried to pull this shit with him, and woof, boy, did he figure that out. But if you look at the UK's, absolutely heartbreaking collapse under Theresa May and Cameron before her into exactly the kind of deception that we've experienced here, something is happening in the modern world. And I think it's pretty simple. I think when you let the world get hijacked by the elite, and they make the world great for themselves and frankly, soul-crushingly difficult and dismaying for others, you create large populations of people, large cross-sections of the population, that become desperate and are willing to sort of throw their lot in with all manner of snake oil salesmen. And the snake oil that is always sold well in times of desperation is fear-mongering and hatred. It's very easy when people are desperate to tell them to blame their equally disenfranchised, hapless neighbor rather than blame you.
Yeah.
It's one of the great tricks in human history. It's almost a biologic feature in the human condition that you can trick people in exactly that way, just like you know that a fish can be caught with a particular type of fly or lure.
Eugene, even though Elvis had what we might call a rebel image, you never saw him taking part in, say, civil rights marches or anti-war protesters. Was that just because it wasn't him? Was that the reason?
I think what happened to Elvis, and I think there's a critical way to look at it and a sympathetic way to look at it. Mm. The critical way to look at Elvis is, here is a kid who grew up very, very informed and inspired by the black community that surrounded him in his youth, and he became he loved the music of the black community, and naturally it came through him when he became an artist, and he took the world by storm largely because he was a white guy playing music with black influence. And so isn't that amazing? And then one gets a sense from people in the film like Chuck D and Van Jones and others, well, wait a minute, then where was Elvis? We understand then how the black community served Elvis. How did Elvis do for the black community? And so I think the next question becomes, okay, how, you know, when the black community really needed Elvis, where was he? Now, along the way, there are charges of racism that I think do not apply correctly to Elvis. And I think Chuck D in the film does a very good job with great precision in reminding us that the issue is not whether Elvis stole black music, because that is not something Chuck D believes. Chuck D believes Elvis played black music, and when he played black music, it was a marvelous thing that he did that. You could have been lynched for doing that as a white guy, and that's actually the sharing of culture, and we should all love that and celebrate that. That's beautiful. He says in the film, you wouldn't tell a young African-American kid not to play classical music because he doesn't have German roots, and likewise, you wouldn't tell Elvis Presley not to play black music. So that's an extremely important point, but it leaves us with the question, okay, great, so we understand that it's noble that he played black music and cool that he played black music, but where was he when the black community then needed him? Well, first they needed him because the white music industry stole from black people. They celebrated the likes of Elvis and did not celebrate the likes of the black community that influenced him. He gets to be the king. He gets huge amounts of money. They don't. They're kind of left by the roadside. But what next happened, to add insult to injury, is that the black community needs Elvis in the civil rights movement, and he's MIA. And why? So the question of why, the critical sense of why, is that he moved on to greener pastures, pun intended. He moved on to richer, money-making pastures, and it just wasn't profitable for him to reach back and bring the black community along. People who know Elvis said, oh, he had black friends. Well, we all know people who have black friends. The question is, at a large level, what did Elvis do to reach back and really bring people along? And you don't see him doing very much, and you don't see him stepping up during the civil rights movement. And there's a genuine and, I think, legitimate criticism to be made there of Elvis's role. But there's also then a sympathy you can apply, and it comes from Emmylou Harris in the film, and it comes from Chuck D. In Emmylou Harris's case, she reminds us Elvis was the first person to whom all of this had happened. He was the first person who became this big a star. He then got recruited by the United States military, drafted to go overseas. He became the poster child of post-war American militarism. So what's he supposed to do, come back in America and join the peace marches when he, 5 minutes ago, became the soldier of choice for a country at war? It's very complex. And it's not that I say he made the right choice. I just want to be understanding, we all don't necessarily know how to make the right choices at given points in history. What are any of us doing right now about the world we live in and the need to step up? We all use Facebook. We know that Facebook is destructive to modern life. We all drive cars that burn petroleum and make our children's future more uncertain. So why don't I stop driving a car? Why don't I walk everywhere? These are all questions that we all face, and I think Elvis faced nothing very different. But to be sympathetic to him, he was like the first, dealing with a lot of this stuff. What am I supposed to do and be? They've got my face up on that U.S. military poster. I'm the poster boy. What am I supposed to do with this civil rights movement? At the same time, the black community needed him, and they got help from Marlon Brando. They got help from Jane Fonda. They got help from Harry Belafonte. So it's not just that a star couldn't do it, but I think he was being seduced by other factors, and he's both to blame for that. And one has to be compassionate about his youth, the simplicity of his roots, the novelty of all that wealth and power. And I come down somewhere in the middle on it, but I think there's great lessons in it for the rest of us in the life that really matters, which is today.
And just finally, Eugene, you might expect or have expected someone like his manager, Colonel Tom Parker, maybe to have guided him more, to directed him more than he seems to have done. Is that a fair point?
I think Tom Parker is, in large measure, the reason he was guided into these directions that we regret.
Yeah.
Tom Parker was not, Colonel Tom Parker was not a colonel. He wasn't Tom and he wasn't Parker. He was a fraud. He was a carny barker from Europe who had come to America and invented a persona for himself and was not a straightforward, simple guy. He was a profit seeker and he did great things for Elvis. He made him incredibly profitable, but it's a purely Faustian story. He constructed a world in which Elvis in many ways sold his soul, and Tom Parker stopped at nothing to push Elvis to be the most profit-making force he could be. And in that way, I think he's the sort of, he's both the greatest thing that ever happened to Elvis in a way, because Elvis thought so. Elvis loved Tom Parker and loved what he did for him. But it was a stop at nothing, approach. And that approach ultimately destroyed Elvis.
Well, thank you. Thank you again. As I said, it's an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
And great speaking with you.
And good luck. Bye-bye. Bye.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
The Picture Show on News Talk.